More T20 World Cup qualifier coverage coming your way, as well as news from all over the cricketing world. Welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast. Thank you for joining us again for the Emerging Cricket Podcast online and on Sport FM in Perth. I'm Daniel Beswick and I'm joined by the two usual suspects. First, Tim Cutler. Tim, how are you?
A little bit sun-touched today, Daniel. I'm a little bit red. I think this sort of Irish skin of mine isn't great in the sun. I've just been out in a boat for the day, so it's a tough one, but I guess I needed it. It was a good old late night watching Hong Kong get their first win over Jersey, so I'm okay. I'm getting through it. How are you, sir?
I'm not too bad. I wonder, did you have sunglasses today? You could do the whole weekend at Bernie's thing and just pretend to be asleep. Not quite dead, but, you know, you could get away with a little nap on the boat.
I did have sunglasses, but it was a sailing boat and a working sailing boat, so there's not really anywhere to hide. but I was the only person to almost go on the water when we tacked really hard and one of the guys, non-professional, was on the wheel, turned too hard, and basically the bottom half of my body that was hanging off the boat, because we were all on one side bringing weight over to get it out of the water and faster, I basically lost half my body under the water. I didn't know what to do because I had one hand on the wire on the side and one hand on a beer, and I didn't know what to do. So somehow my shoes, which I'm, you know, they look like boat shoes, but I don't think they were manufactured to actually go on boats, stayed on, and I was a little bit cooler for a while. So all's well that ends well, but nice day, and all the better to be getting on a plane tomorrow to be heading to the Middle East for the rest of this great event.
Sounds like quite an eventful day. Tim, Nick, better known by many on Twitter as Copernicus Cricket, anywhere close to an eventful day?
No boats, just sleeping in after another late night, pumping out the match reports and watching some cricket.
No rest for the wicked. Let's jump straight in to the coverage today. Let us know where you are enjoying the podcast with the hashtag ECPod. We'll start with the qualifier again today. First, before we do get into the qualifying chat, we do have some breaking news, and it's actually surrounded by two countries competing at the qualifier. Hong Kong have been stripped of hosting the Challenge League, which they were to be hosting next month, and has been given to Oman due to the political activism and the protests going on there. We don't really want to touch on that too much, but they were the reasons given. And some more news coming out of UAE with yet another player out of the UAE squad for the qualifier. Ghulam Shahba disappeared and left just about without a trace and was found safe and sound in Pakistan. Needless to say, he is not to play for UAE for the rest of the tournament, of course, with the wheels coming off there with several players out due to several reasons that we've already mentioned during the podcast. Let's move on into the actual qualifier itself and some telling results over the last 2 days. Let's go through those results quickly now. Singapore lost to the Netherlands by 5 wickets at the ICC Academy ground on October 22, as well as Jersey, defeating UAE in a surprise by 35 runs at the Tolerance Oval on the same day. We saw Namibia beat Bermuda comfortably by 6 wickets, Oman beating Nigeria by 7 wickets, and then Kenya defeating Singapore by 7 wickets. And what was a slight surprise, elsewhere we saw Canada defeat Ireland by 10 runs on the TV match there. We saw Hong Kong beat Jersey by 8 runs. Papua New Guinea then beating the Netherlands by 5 wickets and with 6 balls remaining. UAE, too good for Nigeria, chasing down their target of 112 with 45 balls remaining. Hong Kong were able to tame Canada, beating them by 32 runs at the Tolerance Oval, while Scotland were too strong for Bermuda, making 4 for 204 and restricted Bermuda to just 158. Papua New Guinea sit top of Group A on net run rate over Netherlands and Scotland, each with 3 wins. Scotland, though, have played 5 matches, with the other 2 only playing 4. Kenya, Singapore and Namibia all locked in a 3-way tie for 4th, with Kenya just ahead on net run rate over the other 2, with Bermuda in 7th with 5 defeats. They are now mathematically eliminated from the competition. Canada's defeat to Hong Kong mean that they have slid down to 2nd to Oman on net run rate. They have a match in hand over UAE, who have already played 5 matches and are also on 6 points. Jersey, Ireland and Hong Kong all on 4 points, with Hong Kong there playing an extra game. Nigeria sitting on no points after going 0-4. And some extra news before we do go through the matches and the teams. Three players at the qualifier have been banned from bowling by the ICC after a panel ruled their bowling actions to be illegal. Selador Vijayakumar of Singapore, Tom Sol of Scotland, and Abiodun Abioye have all been suspended from bowling in international cricket with immediate effect. A reminder, as we do talk about the qualifier, we're recording this show before the Hong Kong-Canada result and before the Bermuda-Scotland match today, so we will wrap those in our next show. Let's talk about both groups generally, guys, because we don't really want to get too nitty-gritty into the results gone, because we have talked about them at length already. We want to focus today more on about what teams need to do for the rest of the group stage to get anywhere in this tournament. Group A is a little bit more competitive than Group B, which has shaken out a little bit. It's still a six-way race for four spots, and we're not really any more sure about the teams going through than we were when the tournament started. We'll start with the Netherlands. They recently lost to Papua New Guinea. Their unbeaten streak came to an end. We saw them really struggling at 7-for-70-odd to end up getting themselves to a score in the 120s, but PNG racing home to win that game and helping themselves to the top spot. If we look at the Netherlands fixtures for the rest of the tournament, they play Bermuda on the 26th of October and Scotland it could well be a humdinger of an affair. Tim, I'll start with you. Cambo looks as if he got his team well-rounded despite the loss to Papua New Guinea. You'd think that they'd be too good for Bermuda, but that Scotland game could well turn into an important fixture, especially if you look at how Scotland have performed as well in this tournament, being 2-2.
Yeah, and we talk about how well this tournament is structured in general, but how the ICC do get rather clever with some of their matchups to come down to final days that invariably are quasi-finals, or at least nothing is decided really until that last day of competition. And it looks like we're going to be set for a humdinger, just as you said, with Scotland against the Netherlands, and who knows, like between now and then, lots of things could happen and lots of permutations. But for them to go down to PNG today, who by all accounts again was one of the games at the ICC Academy that wasn't streamed, PNG were just really well drilled and disciplined and did all the little things right, all the things we wanted from them for such a long time, they now brought in spades. You know, and the situation the Netherlands were in with Tim van der Gutten getting to 40 not out, the situation that we're in, potentially it should have been even more comprehensive if we can look at it that way. But again, the openers again put a really good platform down, and I think for the Netherlands, it's going to be interesting to see how they move from these pitches that have been quite pace friendly with the Wacker clay into Dubai International Stadium, the type of wickets that we're going to see there, which are going to be the ones that decide which teams go on to the World Cup.
Yeah, and just looking through PDP's Twitter feed, Peter Della Penna, a good friend of the podcast, who was at the game. Yeah, again, it's a shame we weren't able to watch this because it looked like another great performance from PNG. But and we mentioned this last episode, but they in the 50-over cricket, they just haven't been able to bring their A game, but it sounds like they're really buzzing in the field again, which is, that's the telltale sign that they're playing well, is when they're fielding well and when they're when they've got some zip in the field. Because a few times in Namibia and in the World Cup League 2, they were just a bit down on their usual standards in fielding, and it really showed. So I think the fact that they're back at their best, they're high on confidence, and yeah, knocking over the Netherlands. Yeah, the Dutch, they've been scratchy, and they've got the three wins, but they were just got their one ugly, which, you know, is a good quality to have. But coming into that final game against Scotland, oh, that's going to be an absolute cracker.
Well, just looking at Papua New Guinea's fixtures and their run home, they have Singapore on the 25th and then Kenya on the 27th. They're two banana skin matches. They're two teams that aren't going to lie down. But the key for PNG in this tournament, and we didn't see it in the 50 over stuff, and just to wrap up on Papua New Guinea, Vala and Tony Urr at the top of the order once again flourishing, meaning that there's less pressure on the middle to lower orders. Where do you see Papua New Guinea finishing up? And just quickly, Tim, if they do qualify for Australia, it's a really nice story. It would be a great story to see Papua New Guinea in Australia.
beyond doubt, yes. And yeah, the two countries really couldn't be closer. Very close diplomatic relations, and a lot of that is exercised through a lot of sporting programs and funding. The Australian government is helping to fund some of the pitches that were going in to Papua New Guinea across the country, using the funds out of the World Cup as well, that from 2015. So that would be great. But just in general, and as we're talking about beforehand, they've been so close in different formats. 50 over cricket, they were up there and close in 2014 to make 2015. Oh, so close in 2015 to make the World T20 in 2016 when it was held in India, losing their playoff match. And look, I'm so happy for them, not just because two of the players are emerging cricket ambassadors, but of course that helps, and it'll be great to sit down and talk to them more when I'm in Dubai. But it's just this team of all-around good guys that work their butts off, and everything seems to have come together at the right time, especially when nobody has tipped them to.
Yeah, I didn't have them going through. And yeah, as you say, it's a great story. And like we talked about with Nigeria, they play the game in a really great spirit, and it's just fantastic to watch. I remember going up to Townsville to see PNG take on Ireland in the Intercontinental Cup few years back, and they had a pretty good turnout of PNG fans, who quite a lot of them live and work in Townsville and around that region in North Queensland. So yeah, hopefully if they can make it to the World Cup or T20 World Cup, we'll see some local PNG fans make the trip down to some of their games, because that would just really add to the atmosphere. You know, we've seen the Nepalese traveling fan contingent around the world, and I think it'd be good to see the PNG one as well.
It makes you think, doesn't it, looking at those rounds in Geelong and in Hobart, that it would have been great for PNG fans to get cheaper flights down on Air New Guinea into Brisbane or far north Queensland, as you say, these basically being regional, in inverted commas, I'm sorry to people in Tasmania, but rounds away from the major centres. But yeah, I'm sure we'll see that alongside us being down there watching them as well.
Yes, looking forward to a big road trip.
Oh, yeah. I'll be getting the diary ready and the NA diary at work, a workout at some point next year. That's going to be really great to watch. A team that has built into the tournament really well is Kenya. And they have an interesting run home. They have PNG on the last day of group play in their group, with PNG most likely gunning for that top position and automatic qualification. But they also have an African derby on the 25th of October, taking on Namibia, who are in their own right growing into this tournament. Kenya have surprised a little bit. We've seen the experience of Collins Abuya really come through, especially with the ball. And then Diran Gondaria has taken the responsibility with the bat. Also, you know, some efforts from the Kareems and other players. They have flown under the radar a little bit, but they find themselves well and truly entrenched in this fight in Group A.
Yeah, it makes me think of Russ Degnan when he was on the podcast. He said he just had a feeling that Kenya always do better than you expect in tournament play. And I think the groups with six matches each has really helped. And we did talk about that when we discussed the format. But the fact that you if you lose a couple of early games, you're not out of it, and you can recover and build a bit of a run towards the end. I think it's a pretty good format. And the fact that Kenya have turned it around has, yeah, thrown the group wide open. And, you know, seeing how many teams are on the same number of points and trying to do all the combinations and who's going to end up missing out, is this is what these tournaments are all about.
And the one thing, too, that the first past the post does is that it means that no one rests on their laurels and rests players in the last fixture if they are guaranteed a spot to progress to the next part. We looked at World Cricket League too early in the year, and we saw Oman perhaps rest on their laurels a little bit against Papua New Guinea and lost that match, which actually handed Papua New Guinea a chance to qualify and reach one day international status. But with everyone competing for some on the last day, whether it be topping the group or making the four, it means that there is going to be top quality cricket where everyone's giving 100%, and I'm sure they would be giving 100% just about anyway, but it guarantees it at least, and it means that, yeah, there's everything to play for all teams, and everyone has a motivation going into that last
It week. Also helps when the teams are so evenly matched, and, you know, it's become a real cliche of associate cricket being cutthroat, but when you have so many teams that are easily, you know, capable of beating each other, and this many knockout games coming up, it's going to make for some really tense cricket.
Yeah, well, let's have a look at Singapore now. And Singapore have PNG and Namibia on the run home, and they sit in that logjam in Group A. Tim David hasn't quite had the desired or the ideal tournament thus far, but you feel like once he gets it right, Singapore become an even better side, and they've had contributions from just about everyone. You think of Celador in that spell to beat Scotland at the start of the tournament to really turn a few heads, I suppose, in the whole tournament, given that Scotland were probably red-hot favourites to win that match. Singapore have proven that they well and truly belong in this tournament after beating, first of all, Nepal to come here and then to compete at the level that they are competing at. This is a really exciting time for Singapore cricket, Tim. And once the injection of Tim David comes through, we could well see an even better performance from them.
Yeah, I'm sort of holding my breath there. It's similar to kind of thinking about Tendulkar's effects. You know, he scored 150 thus far and the Netherlands got up in that game. I just think that Tim David's almost the missing piece for Singapore now. Everyone else seems to be doing their jobs. And I'm not saying that he's letting the team down. Quite the opposite, because he's been great in the field as well. I think talking to Ryan Campbell, actually, he said that Tim David might be one of the best fielders he's ever seen. So that's high praise from a guy who's played with and against some amazing cricketers. So that's a bit of a sidebar, but I can't wait to when we can actually watch them, because the last time we watched them were on the streams in the Asia finals, which, don't get me wrong, it was great to watch and to be able to watch, but to be able to now see it in the quality of which it's going to be broadcast, and hopefully to see Tim David bring his A game, that's a team that I'm really looking forward to be able to watch.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where that we know everyone thought Tim David was going to be the, you know, carrying the whole team, and then he's underperformed a bit, and they've still managed to win 2 out of 4. It's good signs, and the fact that they still have room to improve is that's going to encourage them. I'm just a bit worried about the bowling though. They've managed to win 2 games, but they've just not, I don't know, they haven't had as much penetration, to finish off games. They had the Netherlands, I think it was about 5 for 60 chasing 100, which, you know, that's the sort of wobbling situation where if you have, you know, that one strike bowler who can come on and really finish off the chase, that they could perhaps have defended that, but they're the kind of team that has a bunch of guys who do a job. But, you know, when we saw against Kenya, who, you know, Irfan Karim played really well, and Kenya just cruised that chase, I think 3 down, and they were chasing 160. Hopefully they can find something special to help finish off in these situations where they get on top of teams, but then they just let them go a bit.
Let's move to Group B. Group B is a little bit more shaken out, with Canada 3 from 3 and actually having a game in hand over Oman, who also sit on 6 points. I'll start with the Canadians, and Nick, you are probably listening to this with a little bit of a smirk on your face, because they have performed admirably, and you came in really high on your Canadian side. They've proved their weight in the T20 international format. Their match with Ireland last night was a huge hurdle in their hopes, but they overcame that with aplomb. I know they only won that match by 10 runs, but to be honest, they looked in little danger of being chased down after those wickets of Gareth Delaney and then Andrew Balburnie. And it's even think that Canada probably cost themselves 15 to 20 runs in the field. Once they iron those things out, they could well make a case for automatic qualification.
Yeah, I'm fingers crossed. I watched that game. I wasn't as confident as you are. I guess I'm a bit of a nervous watcher. But
I know how that feels. Don't worry.
Yeah, you mentioned the fielding, and that was poor. You know, they missed some chances and, you know, let balls get away from them and run off into the boundary, and it was sloppy. And there was the comedy moment of Rizwan Chima in his big red floppy hat. I think it was about around the sort of extra cover region. Missed 2 balls in a row, let them through for some extra runs. Then they eventually shifted him to point, which was an interesting decision from the captain, Dhaliwal. And yeah, then, of course, a cut shot flew straight to him, and he just couldn't get hold of it. So that was, yeah. And that kind of summed up their fielding, really. But, I mean, Chima's normally, he's still pretty fit for a 41-year-old guy. Normally he's competent in the field. So hopefully it was just a bad day. But, yeah, the other thing, I think, again, they're just struggling a bit in that middle order, and they're still tinkering. I've noticed in the game against Hong Kong, they brought back Abrash Khan and dropped Nicholas Curtin from the middle order. You know, once Nitish Kumar and Dhaliwal got out against Ireland, they really fizzled out and just completely completely ran out of steam, and that was around the 15th over where they really should have been accelerating. And you know, someone like a Ravi Singh, who's coming into this tournament with T20 strike rate around 180-190, and he just sort of knocked it around for 15 or 15 or something. And I'm not sure what's going on in that middle order, but once they get that sorted, I think I'll be a bit more confident in their direct qualification. But yeah, fingers crossed.
It was good to see Romesh Aranga bowl well against Ireland as well. The left arm seamer was one of the leading wicket takers at World Cricket League Division 2. And I'd pulled up one of my tweets from back then when he told me that he's going to have to go back to work. He'd given up his physiotherapy studies. He'd been working as a sports masseuse, but he'd have to go back to that now that his cricket career was going to be over, because you know, there'd been contracts spoken about that would only come in if they were able to qualify for Cricket World Cup League 2. So I'm really happy for the performance of this Canadian side. Jeremy Gordon to come back from niggles and getting on in his cricketing career. For everything that's happened around the team and the pay, to have those contracts that were going to be for T20 players, for global T20 players, that didn't come to fruition. Pay issues during the global T20 involving international and Canadian players. The Canadian players being paid less than what they were originally drafted for at the global T20. But to see the pressure on the outside for a long, proud cricketing nation with 100,000 people playing across a vast landscape, I'm happy to see them proceed. I'm not happy to see the comments continuing online about, well, they're not even Canadians. And I know this is a common thread we get to, and I'm going to be quiet from there. But it just really gets... Anyway, we talk about this enough, so apologies to everyone yeah. listening. As much as I want Hong Kong to defend this and them to sneak into the fourth place playoff, I won't be disappointed to see Canada keep going on, because it keeps the higher associates, shall we say, in League 2. And I know that's a different format, but you know, we kind of rank them the similar ways in our heads, but keeps them on their toes. The problem is they're not going to be playing against these guys too often if they don't make the World Cup, because they're going to be in Challenge League, which is one of those things that we've talked about not having a cycle that allows promotion and relegation, and will Canada potentially be a victim of that? But it also just shows how much talent there is in the teams outside of those ODI nations.
Yeah, it also shows the benefit of preparation. And you mentioned the GT20 and, you know, various unfortunate issues around that. But the fact is, a lot of these guys were playing a fair bit of 2020 cricket. And I do wonder, with the Euro T20 slam collapsing or being postponed or you know, whatever's going on with that, and the Irish, Scottish and Netherlands players all coming into this tournament just a little bit scratchy, I do wonder how much difference it has made to their preparations, the fact that they didn't have that franchise tournament and the fact that the Canadians did. And yes, they are Canadians, and yeah, as someone who is Canadian, but you know, maybe I don't sound Canadian, you'd
passport player.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a real Canadian according to these people, so I find it quite upsetting. And you know, we talked about the elections last week, and you know, the leader of the NDP,
it was only this
one
week.
And thinking back to the election, and you know, the leader of one of the major parties is a guy called Jagmeet Singh, who's an Indian Canadian who, you know, he grew up in Canada and he's faced similar sorts of things as whether he's a real Canadian. And, you know, it's a multicultural country. And yeah, I do find it upsetting that the people have these attitudes towards the players. And let's not forget, you look at the people playing club cricket in Canada, this team accurately reflects that. And, you know, I don't know, what do you expect to go out and pick up a bunch of random Canadians who've never picked up a cricket bat before just because they have, you know, white skin and Anglo-sounding name? It doesn't make sense to me. So moving on.
Before we get derailed into that, Chad, and, you know, we have talked about it at length before, and we will in future. But Tim, you did talk a little bit about Hong Kong there. Hong Kong, obviously, with this game tonight, and then they have Nigeria as their last match. So if they do manage to jag a result here, they do know that they have a good chance to potentially build their net run rate for the Nigeria match, which does give them a glimmer of hope, of course. An outside chance, that'd be a fair statement. But where do you see them improving? We did see Scott McKechnie, man of the match performance, actually, with the bat to get them home against Jersey. Where do you think they pick up the extra 5 to 10% to lift them just that little bit higher?
Well, I'm not sure it's 5 to 10% that they need to lift, but they were the beneficiaries of a Jonty Jenner misstep, shall we say, in that he should have caught Nazakat Khan off the first ball of their match under lights in Abu Dhabi, and Nazakat went on to hit, I think, from the neck. He got two from that delivery, and then it was 4-4-6. One, you know, so ended up being 17 off the first over. Yeah, McKechnie was great. Just him, Wackhouse, Barkat, happy for both of them. Put on 60 odd runs, and Hong Kong won the last few. Well, they won by 8 runs, basically. So got it all the way to the end. What do they need to improve? Look, it's got to be an improvement across the park. They've lost 3 wickets in the first couple of overs in this game against Canada that we're watching the scores on. And look, there's just a lot of work to be done across the board there from number one to number 11. Azaz Khan has been tried up the order a number of times and just hasn't scored runs for Hong Kong up there, and he's already bowling and skippering the side. You know, you've got to think about whether there's better options, especially the young guys coming through. Why not pick someone young and stick with them rather than what Azaz has been delivering? Look, I think they're going to struggle, even if they do win these two games. If they do sneak it against Canada, which will be an upset, quote unquote upset, and then beat Nigeria in the last game, they've still got to hope that Jersey and Ireland have a couple of bad losses, or at least one really bad loss from a net run rate point of view. So, look, I don't hold out a lot of hope. All they can do is trying to come home strong defending this score against Canada that you'll already know listening to this because you've already given everyone the score. And yeah, I still think it's going to be a real banana skin this game against Nigeria. I don't think they're going to play development players in a T20I in a qualifier. But with the momentum with Nigeria coming into this game, and I know that we'll talk about them as well, to have their first player score his first half century in T20I cricket, etc., then, you know, I'd probably be less surprised if Nigeria beat Hong Kong than if Hong Kong are able to make it through to the next round.
A team that I want to talk about is Ireland, because they find themselves in quite a precarious spot. And I know they would have prepared for every team being ultra competitive, but I don't think many people would have them in this logjam sitting where they are. And not only losing to Canada, but losing to UAE, who of course have been experiencing their own trials and tribulations. Gary Wilson looks to be under a little bit of pressure. Their run home is not as simple as it probably should have been at this point. They have Jersey, where the match against Jersey coming up is certainly not a foregone conclusion. And while they are favourites, and they do have Nigeria last, which may well give them a net run rate boost, they're well entrenched in this battle in Group B. I think at the top of the order, Kevin O'Brien might put his hand up and say that he could probably be doing a little bit better. I know he was run out without facing a ball in the first match. We've seen Balburnie come back into the side after being sick. The fast bowling has actually been quite hittable. There are definitely a few questions to be answered from that Ireland side. With Nigeria last and you feel they should win, it means that Jersey match is all important for their aspirations, Tim.
Yes, and Jersey, well, that game will be going on over on Tolerance Oval, which is the nursery ground. That's the same ground where Jersey defeated the UAE, the same team that Ireland lost to. So I wouldn't so much say it's a coin flick considering the relevant performances in the group. You would like to think that Ireland's class will come through here, but Jersey have shown that they're a fighter side. You know, even watching them play against Hong Kong, there's no player, well, apart from Ben Ward, who's been great with his fast leg spinners and sometimes quick balls, and also his hitting has been their best player, but they're just, you feel like you're coming up against a wall, against a team. So if they can get another team performance together, and unfortunately, again, broken record, we can't watch it. But yeah, it's going to be all down at those quick starts with O'Brien and Sterling. Balburnie, whether he's still feeling it and ill, you know, that shot he played, albeit on one that kept a little bit low that first game back from his ill break, that foot wasn't moving, but it's hard to tell from one ball. So with Delaney hitting the ball like he is, will he get a chance back up at number three as well? But like you mentioned, as you led in about their fast bowling, how will that go on that Tolerance Oval wicket that seems a little bit more suited for runs rather than fast bowling like the stadium wicket?
Oman finished with Canada and Jersey, and Oman lost to Ireland. We've talked about Oman a lot. We have seen Oman play quite a bit as well. They have the talent across the board. Where do we see the improvement coming from there? Because, look, it's tough to say. Sometimes for Oman, we have many different individual performers performing at key times. They're almost just hoping that someone performs on a particular day. But having that run home with Jersey and with Canada, they've got themselves in a tricky spot. They've already played the considerably easier fixtures in this one, Tim. They come up against Canada on the 25th, and that's probably going to be their greatest test of this tournament so far.
Yes, and we probably would have picked that from the start of us thinking Oman was close to the favourite in the group, but the way that Canada's been playing, you'd say that they're probably equal pegging for favourites tags. And like you said, we've spoken about Oman at length, and let's just see how they go now that they're under a bit of pressure. You know, with their two games to go, you know, they've already had their Nigeria game for their chance to get some net run rate, which they did, and their last day against Jersey, and like we've spoken about in the past, when they slipped up against PNG on that last day when there wasn't a lot to play for in World Cricket League 2. But this game against Canada is going to be a key one to see, especially if they're chasing. You know, if I'm Canada, I'm actually thinking that bat first, get a score on there and put that Oman order under pressure, because that was what they weren't able to bring home against Ireland, albeit they were chasing 180 odd and got to 150, which is still a good score, but not when you're chasing 180. That's another good matchup, which we will be able to watch on TV. One of the last ones in Zayed Stadium. Yes, I think we know what they're capable of, but let's just see which Oman turns up on the 25th.
Yeah, no, I think this game against Canada will be, for Oman, it will be probably the way the group's shaping up. It's going to be determining who finishes first and gets that automatic qualifying slot. And so there's, as you say, there's a lot to play for, and tension, so much tension. It's great, isn't it, this back end of the tournament?
Yeah, well, even more so that Nasrullah Rana just got Rodrigo Thomas out. So might be good. We're going to have a kind of a running... For everyone else, I know the result, but this is us finding out where you've got the Hong Kong guy talking to the Canadian yes. guy. Canada are 14 for one after three overs. So we'll keep going, kids.
A couple more teams to look at for Group B, UAE and Nigeria. We'll start with UAE, and we've talked about the off-field stuff. As a unit, they had put together a couple of really good performances to begin the tournament, but it's just starting to look like the threadbare nature of their squad has just let them down a little bit, and it's becoming a little bit too much. We do say this with them playing Canada on the last match day. They've already played five matches, of course, which doesn't really help them because everyone else knows what they have to do. Canada, probably the best team in the group thus far, if we're being honest with ourselves. Ahmed Raza's done really well to patch things together, and there's been some great individual performances, particularly from Rahman Mustafa. We've talked about that already. But it becomes basically a one-match shootout for UAE here, because they could easily just find themselves just out in that fourth, fifth bubble.
They're in real danger here of skipping back. And if you think of those moving graphs that you've seen on Twitter with the visualization of data of positioning of number one teams and of population or GDP and whatnot, it's a bit like this, where the way that they've started, except they've been jutting backwards and forwards. And if they don't win this last game against Canada, and like you said, everyone knows what they need to do, but this will actually be the last game in Group B. It's the last game to be played in the group stages. But by that stage, if Canada has potentially beat Hong Kong, although we're hoping not as we're live commentating as we go, if Oman win one or two, and if Ireland get some results, they might find themselves in fifth spot, which of course means that they're out of contention. Or if Hong Kong wins a couple of games, they might even skip over the top two. So I think we talk about which Oman will turn up. Likewise with the UAE, they're now down five players, one running. Like, when was the last time you heard of a player hot skip jumping it from the country he actually represents? Well, during a tournament, we've heard about players and athletes staying in countries where they've travelled to for an event and claiming refugee status or just going MIA. But is this the first time that someone's actually left the country for which they're representing during an event to flee back to their country of origin? It's just a bizarre story. And look, it's all nods and winks about whether he's being investigated and whether he's one of the Al Jazeera five, shall we say. But it's just a shambles, really, and I feel for the guys left behind. But yeah, which UAE is going to turn up and how many players they're going to have? I think Paul Radley from the National in the UAE, who I look forward to spending some time with, said it's like Big Brother, you know, who's going to get voted out of the house this match for the UAE. And I think he couldn't have put it better.
Dhaliwal's just been bowled by your one to watch, Haroon Ashad. Yes, the UAE, it's bizarre, isn't it? Seeing all these guys, the wheels are really falling off. And I think, I mean, maybe I'm just being a bit hopeful, but I think they will struggle against Canada, especially if Canada mess up this chase against Hong Kong and really need those points in the last game. Because, yeah, Rohan Mustafa's been great. But other than that, they've been pretty threadbare, as you said, Bez. Just looking at, you know, looking forward to the World Cup proper, I don't really see them performing on that stage. So I think, you know, from a tournament perspective, I'd like perhaps other teams to make it through instead of them, because I think just with all the drama going on at the moment with the match fixing investigations and whatnot, I think it probably would be better for the World Cup to have a team that's maybe not in so much turmoil.
And for context, if we're thinking about bans and potential bans going forward, if in case they do qualify and who may be available, when Irfan Ahmed was first banned for failing to report, and of course this went on to him actually being done for fixing, but failing to report a corrupt approach, he was out of the game for 2 years anyway then. So even if these guys are say not guilty of serious charges but of less serious breaches of the code, they're not going to be at the World Cup. So I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's an interesting perspective to think that will they be there actually putting the best foot forward. But I guess that's down to the teams that they're playing against here at the qualifier, because it's not like any of those players that are going to be banned, let's say, are playing at the moment. If the team, the bit part team that they've got at the moment, are able to get through, then good luck to them. They'll have done well. But yeah, like, as you said, that threadbare, and I do like that you weren't talking about Rowan's hair again this time. Good response.
If
Mustafa doesn't perform, then UAE don't win. I think that's basically been the mantra for them this tournament. And look, he's been a pillar of strength between him for the UAE and the likes of Norman Vanua with the all-rounder and Richie Barrington for Scotland. It's really been a shining, well, and Jan Frielinck as well for Namibia, that the all-rounders are really starting to shine through, whereas we probably haven't seen too much of that in the past in associate cricket, whereas there's a couple of star players with bat or ball. Yeah, we talk about the new world of T20 cricket and the likes of PNG that are all-rounders, but to actually see players perform with bat and ball and make game-changing performances consistently is good to see.
Finally, let's have a look at Nigeria's campaign. We knew coming into this that they were going to have a difficult time of it. Certainly the most competitive and most difficult cricket that many of these players have ever played. We have seen consistently improved performances from them, and we've also seen the first 50 in T20 international cricket for Nigeria scored by Sesan Adedeji in a great partnership with Tumezi Onwuzulike. Where do we see them going from here, boys? We know that a lot of them are playing in the Under-19 World Cup next year, and we do have some news on the groups of those Under-19 World Cup teams a little bit later in the show. Consistently improving every match, which is great to see. They take on Hong Kong and Ireland in their last two fixtures. Most likely see them without a victory. What's a pass mark for them in the last two games here?
Look, what's a pass mark going to be? It's, you know, you go back in and it's to look at the games that they've lost. They've had some blowouts. I'd say less than 50 runs would be a good one for them, and not allowing teams to be chasing it down with more than five overs to go. That didn't happen against Oman, and UAE chased it down the 13th over just to set some of those realistic targets, because the bowling's been quite good and quite tight. It's always tough defending something like 70. Been in that situation before myself, and a lot of times teams will come out and just throw the bat, and it's not almost like it's a surreal game of cricket, that it's not really real, because you know what, you're throwing the bat at it and it's just going everywhere. We struggled so much, what's going on? The controllables for them that they can work on in the meantime before they work on the technical aspects: fielding. There just seems to be some things around there that they need to get some better spikes. We've seen them slipping around the dew, but as their captain said, it was the first time they'd ever played under lights, and you know, I hadn't even thought about that. I went back and I was looking at the videos when we were getting up the match reports, and I saw the post-match press conference or the captain's interview, and we said, oh, well, it's the first time we've been under lights, and he sort of shrugged it away, the fielding and the footing, and I was like, dearie me, you don't even think about these things. You see them play under lights, we're thinking about what time it is for us, oh dear, it's late, and well, it's good that it's on TV, and where's the crowd? But then these guys have never hit a cricket ball, caught a cricket ball under lights before, so look, expectations can't be too high with the matches they've got left. I think they've just got to go in there and keep doing what they're doing, have fun, and just keep learning.
Yeah, and it, you know, obviously it's not rocket science, but if you play more, you get better, and they have shown that. I think we talk about getting associates into the tournaments to get more exposure. And yeah, that's definitely part of it, but they need the games outside the tournaments, because you can't just be relying on tournament play to practice your game and to improve. So I guess going forward, looking a bit further afield than just this tournament, what a pass mark would be. I think what they need to be doing is getting more games for the team against regional opponents. You know, we saw the sub-regionals that they hosted in Lagos, which they won through, and that was good. And so the new pathway, which does provide a bit more regular cricket for these teams below the ODI setup, is good. So I think, just getting more... We've seen a lot of these bilateral T20 series popping up in a lot of places you might not expect. So getting a lot of more regular games and just tournament and or bilateral play.
Well, it has been an excellent tournament in many ways, the World Cup qualifier. A team, unfortunately, didn't qualify for this event due to Singapore's quality was Nepal. And we've seen the conclusion of the Nepal's Women's Champions League. It's the first T20 franchise competition of its kind in Nepal. Quite commendable from them to even put together a tournament when many full member nations are struggling to put together women's franchise leagues. We've seen the final run and done. The Chitwan Rhinos went unbeaten and beat the Cat Queens of Kathmandu in the final. Tim, asking you the same question, the point that I just made, but it's brilliant for them to get this tournament up and running. And for a cricket-mad country like Nepal, the world's really their oyster on the female front, because I'm sure there is enough quality around to, first of all, compete as a Nepali national team, but then to build and grow the sport through a women's franchise league.
Yes, I think there's a number of points to consider here, but first to congratulate the Nepali cricket community, because remembering it's the cricket community putting these leagues together, whether it's private enterprise or not, and it's not the Cricket Association in Nepal that has been reinstated conditionally. So that's just shows how much passion there is for the game in Nepal. And if we'd been worried that women's cricket maybe left behind the interest in the men's team after, especially that news item from a couple of months ago, the women's team returned from a qualifier after missing out by one place to Thailand and having nobody at the airport to greet them, to then see this, it warms the heart and maybe instills a bit of confidence that there is that support there. You look at how successful the Women's Big Bash has been, and the Kia Super League as it exists now before it turns into the 100. It just shows that this could be done a lot better around the world. And I don't know who I'm talking to. I'm talking to the game when I'm saying this, but at the same time, it might have even been Berkey that was talking about this. We talk about the challenges of match fixing in associate cricket and saying that it's something like, decades behind full member cricket, and there's not enough money around to make sure kids coming through the system are educated right early on, and there's so little money in the emerging game that players can be bought for a lot cheaper, shall we put it that way, that crudely. But women's cricket as well, the more that women's cricket is shown on TV, we know that people will bet on two cockroaches going up a wall if it's on TV. So the more and more women's cricket that's going to be played, that means more people are going to be betting on it, which means there's going to be more people wanting to manipulate results of periods or of games themselves. So this is something that I think that global cricket needs to get its head around pretty quickly as well, as to make sure that as women's cricket is dragged into the spotlight, elevated, I should say, into the spotlight as it rightly should be, that the players are correctly and dutifully educated around the challenges that comes around match fixing and bookies and whatnot.
That's a very prescient point there, Tim. I think you're absolutely right. As we've seen with associate cricket and, the mess that the UAE is in, for example, with the players, five so far seemingly embroiled in this match-fixing controversy. The other point to remember, of course, with women's cricket is that the women's sport itself is a growing market, and we see this with a lot of sports. They're all investing very heavily because being at the forefront of the market is going to be such a big advantage. And I think, as you said, Bez, the world is their oyster. If Nepal can get a functional women's league going, that'll put them ahead of quite a lot of full members, actually. And, looking at the amount of, whether cricket gets into the Olympics or not is another question, but, we've seen it be accepted into the Commonwealth Games on the women's side, but not the men's side. So having a functional women's program, I think going forward, is going to be more and more important. So this is going to put them in good stead for future development, as the new board that has just been
you know, had their suspension lifted, as they look to move forward and, you know, where are they going to take the game? I think women's cricket is something they need to have front and centre.
And talking to people in Nepal about how future structures could look, it's good to hear them talking about men's and women's cricket and the tournaments side by side, not, you know, we'll get the men sorted and then worry about the women down the line because there's so much to get done. It's just good to see that it is where it should be, where they're just one and the same and considered side by side.
Well, I don't think I have anything to add there that you guys haven't touched on, but I will reiterate that if they get this right, it's a huge door to unlock to really harness the potential of all Nepali cricket across both men's and women's cricket. And if they can do it and push it, again, to use the same cliche, that the world is their oyster, they've got enough fan backing and they've got enough support and they've definitely got enough talent around the place with 30 million people. You know, it should be easy enough to find 11 men's and women's national players, and with T20 tournaments on both sides of things, that will only help the game. And yeah, with the reinstatement of the Nepali board, it means that they can multi-prong their attack, not only between the franchise tournaments, but through the board and building domestic cricket in that way as well. So yeah, positive signs. Plenty of news to wrap up today's bumper show. The Czech Republic has taken out the Valletta Cup, the men's T20 quadrangular series in Malta. Malta's matches against the Czech Republic were considered T20 internationals, but with the Hungarian side not being an official team and Iceland not being an associate member, matches involving them were not. The Czechs were too good for the Hungarian 11 in the final, with Sabuun Divizi named player of the tournament. Elsewhere in Europe, the Iberian Cup is underway at the La Manga Club in Spain. All matches between the hosts, Portugal and Gibraltar, will all carry T20 international status and will be streamed by the European Cricket Network. The Under-19s Cricket World Cup draw has been released this week. Japan will face defending champions India, New Zealand and Sri Lanka, while fellow debutants Nigeria meet Australia, England and the West Indies. Group C sees Pakistan, Bangladesh, Zimbabwe and Scotland play, while Group D includes Afghanistan, South Africa, UAE and Canada. And finally, it was a tight race in our poll where we asked you who should the MVP medal for the men's T20 World Qualifier be named after. Kevin O'Brien edged the public vote with 29%, with Peter Boren, Bob Woolmer and Asghar Afghan polling 27%, 24% and 20% respectively. To keep up with news from Cricket's New World, make sure to follow Emerging Cricket on your favourite social media platforms and make sure to give us a 5-star rating wherever you are listening to the podcast. For now, from myself, Daniel Beswick and the boys, Tim Cutler and Nick Skinner, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world.